Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, August 15th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, we'll be talking to Dahlia Shenlin from 972mag.com, live from Tel Aviv. Also on the program later in the show, I may end up being in the members section, frankly, Anonymous strikes back at BART. BART, the San Francisco Bay Transit Authority, using the same tools and methodologies as the U.S. has criticized, whether it was in Egypt or throughout the Arab Spring. More on that, I get that may be in the membership section. Peeing some France in Iraq, also in the membership section. Could be the other shoe will drop on News Corp tomorrow. Very possibly, we'll talk about that. And, of course, a wonderful story about a wonderful anti-gay, gay state legislator in Iowa. He hates gays, but only because he hates himself. An update on the latest Affordable Care Act ruling in a federal appellate court. This thing is heading to the Supreme Court, but before we get to my interview with Dahlia Shenlin, amazing going. We talk about the riots in the UK. We talk about Los Indignados in Spain, the protests in Greece, of course, the Arab Spring. And in Israel, it's fascinating. Protests that have seemingly nothing to do with what we perceive as their main issue. These protests about privatization, the Israelis extremely unhappy with the direction of their country in terms of economics, as well they should be, and as well we should be in this country. New York Times over the weekend had two very interesting pieces, one on the White House debating on how to deal with the economy from a political perspective. We'll get to that story later in the program, and how Republicans are supposedly on the defensive for being anti-empirical when it comes to the economy. Nothing like reporting that a little bit late in the wake of this this debt ceiling deal, and as we wait for the Super Congress, this group of 12, is it fair to call them plutocrats? Servants to the plutocracy, get together and decide how they're going to essentially rescind promises of social insurance that Americans have paid into for generations. Today in the New York Times, I guess this was yesterday, Warren Buffett, the billionaire tycoon, writes an op-ed, "Stop coddling the super rich. Our leaders have asked for shared sacrifice, but when did they do the asking? When they asked, they spared me. I checked with my mega rich friends to learn what pain they were expecting. They too were left untouched. Some of us are investment managers who earn billions from our daily labors, but are allowed to classify our income as carried interest, thereby getting a bargain 15% tax rate. Others own stock index futures for 10 minutes and have a 60% on their gain taxed at 15%. And if they had been as if they had been long-term investors. You understand that these tycoons who make their money through finance, they don't pay regular income tax. They're not subjected to the reduced tax rate of the Bush era, 32% on their income. No, they pay 15% because it's capital gains, because what they had to do was actually press a button and buy something and then sell it 10 minutes later. And so they deserve a even bigger tax break than Bush gave them if they were actually working. Last year, he writes, my federal tax bill, the income tax I paid, as well as payroll taxes paid by me on my behalf. Of course, you know, he's a billionaire, but only the first $100,000 of his annual income is taxed by Social Security and FICA. His tax bill was nearly $7 million. That sounds like a lot of money, but what I paid was only 17.4% of my taxable income. And that's actually a lower percentage than was paid by any of the 20 other people who work in our office. Their tax burdens range from 33% to 41% and average 36% because they pay federal income tax on what they make. And they pay 6.34% on their as payroll tax. And of course, because they're not making millions of dollars, it's a higher percentage. Last year, 80% of these revenues that came into the government came from personal income taxes and payroll taxes. The mega rich pay income taxes at a rate of 15% on most of their earnings, but pay practically nothing in payroll tax. Relative, again, as a percentage of their income. It's a different story for the middle class. They fall into the 15 and 25% income tax brackets, and then they're hit with heavy payroll taxes to boot. I have worked with 60 investors for 60 years, and this is where he actually addresses the notion that libertarians fantasize about going galt and the Laffer curve, and that if you tax people too much, they're not going to want to make any more money. I have worked with investors for 60 years and have yet to see anyone, not even when capital gains rates were 39.9% in 1976. Remember, they're 15% today. Shy away from a sensible investment because of the tax rate on the potential gain. People invest to make money, and potential taxes have never scared them off. No one's going to say, I'm not going to invest in this and press this button to buy a piece of paper with a 50 or 60% return if that's subject to 28 or 32% or 40% tax. My little finger will get tired if I have to pay a higher tax rate. In 1992, he writes, the top 400 income earners in the country had aggregate taxable income of $16.9 billion and paid federal taxes of 29% on that sum. In 2008, the aggregate income of the highest 400 had soared to $90.9 billion. $90.9 billion from $16.9 billion. A staggering 227.4 million on average, but the rate paid had fallen to 21.5%. So by any measure, they're paying 8% less taxes, effective tax rate, on the millions they're making. And remember, as you have the income concentration move up the scale, less money is actually captured by the payroll tax, which is why we're seeing issues with Social Security not being able to pay its own way after 2037. Job one, though, however, he writes, for these 12 plutocrats on this committee is to pare down some future promises that even a rich America can't fulfill. In other words, let's cut some Social Security and Medicare. But my friends and I have been coddled long enough by a billionaire-friendly Congress. It's time for our government to get serious about shared sacrifice. Let me tell you why Buffett's numbers make a compelling case, but his frame is completely wrong. First off, the idea of shared sacrifice implies that somehow this is a moral obligation by people, and that may be the case. But this isn't about sacrifice. The reason why our economy has had such stagnant wages for 30 years for middle-class Americans, the reason why we see underfunding in Social Security 30 years out, is because we have too much money concentrated in too few hands. Economists call this excess capacity, and it is debilitating our economy. So forget fairness, forget shared sacrifice. They have too much money for society to function properly. This argument was made back in 1786 by Jefferson when it came to big property barons holding too much property. And it's the same argument Nouriel Roubini is making today about excess capacity. And then the second thing that Warren Buffett gets wrong is this notion that we are coddling our billionaires. As if Congress just sort of likes them and treats them with kid gloves for no other reason than they're nice. We are not seeing the coddling of our billionaires. We are seeing the billionaires gain so much money that they have an inordinate amount of control over our government. And because they have this control, they force policies that benefit them. This is not happenstance. This is not an accident. This has been a long-term project by billionaires and millionaires in this country, not all of them, to force policy decisions that necessarily benefit them. And this is a zero-sum game. When you have policy decisions over the past 30 years, as they came out in a Princeton study, that favor the rich, guess who the losers are? The other 98%, 94%, however you want to calculate this, rest of Americans. And so that's where Warren Buffett gets it wrong, and maybe he can't say this. Maybe it's enough for him to say, just change the tax policy and I won't give up the ghost that we are running things in this country despite the fact that we're supposedly in a democracy. But that's the fact. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about this fight in the context of another country, one which started with socialist roots. One in which the people in this country believe that government has a responsibility, a fundamental responsibility because of its very existence, to take care of all the people, not just the rich. We'll be right back in just a moment with Dahlia Shenlin from 972mag.com. On the phone, Dahlia Shenlin. She is a public opinion specialist and a political analyst and a frequent contributor to 972 Mag. You can find it at 972mag.com. We're talking to you from Tel Aviv. And Dahlia, just give us some background. What has happened in Israel over the past couple of weeks? Because there's been an incredible dearth of reporting on it in this country.
Yeah, well, the social protests that have been sweeping the country really started as a very small movement, not even a movement, just a small, almost spontaneous protest by a group of young people. Really, actually, it was focused on one woman who was a 25-year-old who felt that her rent was just too high and her landlord was going to raise her rent. So she said, I'm going to go pitch a tent as a protest in the middle of Rothschild Boulevard, which is aptly named one of the more Tony neighborhoods of Tel Aviv and one of the sort of fashionable neighborhoods. And she got together with a group of people on Facebook. I can mention that on Facebook there have been various groups that have been thinking very, very critically about Israel's current social and economic policies, who have organized various demonstrations in the past and had done some smaller political organizing up to then. They joined forces with her and they pitched about 10 tents in the middle of this fashionable boulevard, and all of a sudden they tapped into a nerve. Israelis started to say, wow, we agree, our rent is too high, and housing is just unaffordable, we can't buy homes. and let's join the protest. And all of a sudden, within about a week or two, it really spiraled to proportions that nobody really expected, including the protesters themselves.
And
when that happened...
And so this started in mid-July, and within 2 weeks or so, there were literally hundreds of thousands of people involved in this protest.
Yeah, what happened was they began calling for mass demonstrations on Saturday nights. The first Saturday night, there was a huge turnout, and by the second Saturday night, there were about 150,000 people, or roughly, of course, the police counts are hard to know exactly. Then, on the third Saturday night, it went viral in modern parlance, and all over the country, people started turning out in massive numbers, until we reached about 300,000 people, which I have to say is really the biggest mass protest around the country that Israel's ever seen. I mean, it's a country that's used to big demonstrations. We've had big demonstrations in the past, usually surrounding conflict-related issues or war. But this is definitely by far the biggest social protest we've ever had that's focused on economic issues. And at this point now, the biggest mass movement I think we've seen in Israel.
And people need to keep in mind, when we're talking about 300,000 Israelis on the streets, that's the functional equivalent of 6 or 7 million Americans on the streets of the United States. I mean, I don't know that we've ever seen anything like that.
Yeah, it might even be more. It's about 4% of our population.
And give me a sense of context here, because I think in this country, when we talk about issues dealing with Israel, it is almost exclusively we're talking about conflict with Palestinians and the peace process and whatnot. And this is completely... And almost, it seems, from what I've read, specifically separate from that.
Yeah, I mean, it raises a number of very interesting points. I think the two biggest points I would keep in mind is that Israel comes to this with a very, almost a radically different perspective from the U.S. In the U.S., there is no expectation of social and economic equality. The U.S. is built on the premise that there is going to be inequality and that whoever, you know, works hardest wins, supposedly. Of course, we all know the system is skewed in too many ways. But in Israel, you know, remember, the country was really founded on a much more a socialist ethos. And that has been eroded over the last few decades by very calculated government measures, from both governments, I should say, really, but largely, moved ahead by the Likud governments, the more right-wing, conservative, and free market-based parties, to privatize the economy and sell off state assets and do all the things that we see modern global economies doing. That's resulted in a very strange situation where Israel went from being one of the most equal countries in terms of its country's socioeconomic status among citizens, to the country with one of the highest gaps between various citizens in the country that we see in the Western world. And this is well documented. You can compare it to other countries in the OECD. And this is something that we hear about all the time, how the rich are getting richer and the tycoons, as we love to call them, are eating up, you know, huge segments of the market while regular people are earning salaries that are just too low to pay most of their bills. I can tell you that most Israelis, or many Israelis, just live in overdraft, which is something I never heard of until I moved to Israel, because in America, people just don't live in overdraft, although they certainly have big credit bills. So that's one thing. There is still, apparently, a 63-year-old expectation that there should be more equality in society, and the state is responsible for providing it, which is something totally antithetical to American sensibilities. The other thing is, as you point out, there is a great effort to remove this or divorce this from the conflict with the Palestinians. And I think something that our international audiences don't always understand is that Israelis really went through peace fatigue. I don't know if you remember, about a year ago, there was a Time magazine cover story, "Why Israelis Don't Care About Peace." And everybody went crazy. How could they say this? It can't be. But as a pollster, I can tell you that for the last number of years, Israelis just gave up on the possibility. They didn't see any way it could happen. There was no hope for any sort of a peace process. They have an amazing ability to live within the status quo of the present and not think about the future. And when things are like that, they started focusing on their social and economic issues. And in the minds of many Israelis, these two issues really can be divorced, at least for the present.
It's interesting. All right. Well, just to give us a little bit more background, because I don't think people realize, I mean, when I grew up and I learned about Israel, it was not terribly controversial to say that Zionism equals socialism in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
Just give us a little bit more of a context of that, and how is it codified in the Israeli charter, and what are the roots of it?
The roots of Israeli socialism go way back to the beginnings of Zionism. It grew out of 19th century thinking and, you know, European thinking and all the trends that, you know, all the various intellectual communities in Europe who were the main fathers of Zionism. And when they first arrived in Israel and began building the country, of course, the kibbutz movement was very central, the kibbutz being these small farming collectives. It was all about redeeming the land, living from agriculture and living communally and sharing things and being very equal. And even the people who didn't live in a kibbutz basically had that ethic, to the point where, you know, I can just give you a little color. When material comfort started to enter Israeli society and people began buying more material goods, I guess in the 70s, some people had color TVs and some people didn't. And the government decided that not everybody should have color TVs if some people only have black and white TVs. So they invented something that would wipe out the color on the color TVs so that everybody could see equally. I mean, this was the ethic that was so pervasive in Israeli society. But what happened was, mostly in the early 90s, but even before that, really when the Likud first gained power in 1977 and in that first term of the Likud in the early 80s, they began a series of, you know, attempts to modernize the market, modernize the system. It began again with various, you know, plans to sell off state assets and privatize some of the major companies. And that's what's been going on since that time. Again, really under both governments, but certainly Netanyahu has, you know, our Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has a very ideological, free market, liberal, you know, neoliberal approach to the economy. And again, he's not solely responsible, but I mean, our health care has been privatized, although we do have universal health care, unlike the U.S. But I think the major focus of the anger here is on the sense of concentration of wealth in the market, which is quite high. And this means that a very small group of people are holding major portions of the Israeli of assets in the Israeli economy. So it's almost as if instead of having a government monopoly over those industries, now we have a private monopoly over them. We do have an antitrust authority, but tell you the truth, I don't know where they've been all these years because, you know, these so-called families or individuals who are holding major assets are really very concentrated. The wealth is very concentrated in their hands. They own many different groups in various fields of the country. And in a number of those fields, it feels like there really isn't any competition. So the prices can just rise, and consumers consistently feel like they're getting gouged. And again, it's been for several decades. It's been this way for several decades. But the consciousness that this is not how it's supposed to be apparently is very resilient in the Israeli psyche.
I mean, it's fascinating because on one hand, I think I've heard that Israel has the highest number of entrepreneurs, or it's one of the leading sort of countries in
holders
terms
of patents.
Of holders of patents and
per capita.
And so, in some ways, I mean, what we have here is a perfect model for free market policies, where by one measure, Israel is one of the most, if not the most successful capitalist countries in the world, but it is not succeeding for the average citizen.
Right. I mean, this is exactly the line that the Prime Minister has been trying to take. You know, this also shows the failure of some of those typical economic indicators that the politicians in particular, love to talk about, and the press does too. I mean, people always love to talk about the low rate of unemployment right now. We have 5.7 unemployment. It's considered, you know, it's remarkably low. We have decent growth. We rode out the financial crisis. And so by those measures, we're doing fine, but what this really shows is that the system doesn't trickle down, which I thought was a very passé kind of concept, trickle down economics. You know, I grew up on it in the 80s in the States, and I saw the mess that it made there. But apparently this has been sort of the philosophy here in Israel, without necessarily saying so. So you do see, you know, the richer class, some of them are the major tycoons and industrialists, and some of them, as you point out, are the ones who've been very successful in the global, you know, the new global economy based on the high-tech sector. And they are living, you know, very good lives, with a level of opulence that I think most people here will never, you know, most people in these protests can never reach. And then I wanted to say that I think, as a word of, you know, a bit of a critical angle, I honestly think that these protesters are not talking about going back to a socialist society and non-materialist values. They're talking about bringing back a welfare state and strengthening aspects of the welfare state. But I think what they really mean is to do that very much within the overall framework of a strong, robust, free global market. And I say that because I know these people. I live with them. I'm from Tel Aviv. I see the people who started this. And they and we and the whole country are very much participants in consumer culture. They want consumer goods. They want material items. And they buy the stuff, and they want to appreciate, you know, American levels of consumerism. But they want a more stable social welfare system or social safety net to live in. So I think that they're not talking about a total revolution of consciousness the way some of their signs proclaim. But those kinds of details are only coming out now as they really begin to focus a little more on policy.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that. Is there a paradox there? I mean, are they simply talking about levels of support rather than a radical radical return, I guess, to a different sort of system? I mean, that's a tough needle to thread, isn't it?
Yes. And I would dare say that as another word of critique, that I think that when this protest started, again, it was just a small group of young people who really thought about pitching tents to protest housing prices, and they didn't really think that it would get this big or get this far, nor I think did they really have a sense that it was going to take on such proportions of talking about the entire economic system. So, you know, from many conversations that I've been having with them, and I spend many hours in the tent camp in Rothschild talking to people, I don't think they really thought all this stuff out at first. And so you really see ideas evolving as the protests go on. So I will say that I think what they're really asking for from everything, from the sort of sum total of everything I can see coming together, is a strengthening or reinforcing of the welfare state that basically, to some extent, does exist in Israel, to a far greater extent in the U.S. And sometimes, you know, as an American who moved here, I really feel the contrast is so striking, considering the healthcare debate going on in the U.S. and the current situation of healthcare, you know, versus our universal system here. But what they're really saying is, let's strengthen those, let's make them better. Things have been cut back, the social system has been eroding. We need to make sure that they're going to be around forever and change policies to reinforce what we used to have. They are not talking about a total revolution of the system. And again, partly because I think Israelis really, really do like their creature comforts, and they want to be able to buy things and enjoy the full range of what global society has to offer in terms of consumer items. The other thing, which is really a different question and is now again evolving as part of the debate, is the question of change priorities. Because, you know, it's one thing to say this government has a neoliberal policy and is really focused on the tycoons and the implications of politicians helping the holders of capital, as we call them here. But the other question is, where are the country's national priorities going? The other major question is, when we look at how the state distributes its resources, what percentage of it is going into our national defense? What percentage is going into Israel's continuing occupation of the West Bank and its hold over Gaza? Even though we're not occupying Gaza, we still control entry and exit. And, you know, the questions are now starting to arise. To what extent are those just placing too great a burden on the state to the point where it can't provide citizens with the support they feel they deserve? And that also comes into questions of which populations inside Israel aren't contributing enough, are living off of the social welfare system and taking advantage of it. Again, there are some internal contradictions here. Our social welfare system is strong enough to support whole populations whose ethic is not to work. And I refer specifically to the ultra-Orthodox population, who has, dramatically lower employment levels because it's their ideology. Of course, you also have the sector of Palestinian citizens of Israel, Arabs who stayed here in 1948 and have citizenship, who have much lower levels of employment, but for quite different reasons. Not because they want to be unemployed, but because they have trouble integrating into the job market. And those populations are, receiving much more state benefits than your average working person in Tel Aviv, who is already earning a low salary, paying high taxes, and has a cost of living that's commensurate with, you know, New York, Paris, or Rome.
Huh. And so, is it fair to say that it's a combination of one, once the population was not, once, I guess I should say, the idea of peace became less viable, their political awareness turned to this other sector, I guess, of their lives. To what extent does the Egypt Spring have influencing what's going on there?
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, Israelis are very attuned to the Egypt Spring. This was a fascinating development for Israelis. They've never seen anything like it. Of course, you know, in the whole world, nobody has seen anything like it. And I do think that it had an influence, to tell you the truth. You know, it would be a little too simple to say, well, Israelis lost hope and peace, so they started thinking about their internal problems. I'm sure that's part of it. I think that's part of the story. But I do think there was a buildup of decades of frustration of people who just felt like cost of living was too high. And it might have happened regardless of the situation, although fair to say that if we had a war going on right now, we wouldn't be doing this.
Right.
And I think that, you know, given that the security situation here, as we call it, has been pretty calm, I would argue that it's an illusion that the security situation is a ticking time bomb as long as there's not a resolution, but that's just my personal opinion. For many Israelis, as long as there aren't terrorist bombs going off, you know, they're able to focus on these other things. And so, sure, you know, there is that connection, but I do think that it's fair to say that Israelis were very attuned to also how so many, you know, millions of people in the Arab world just all of a sudden stood up and said to their governments, no, you know, no, you have to give us what we need. And they certainly took inspiration from their methods. You know, that's sort of the easiest part of it. Israeli society is extremely internet connected. We have about 75% internet penetration or internet connection throughout the country. Israelis, you know, Facebook has taken over. It was a natural fit
right.
for Israelis because they're very, very socially connected anyway. Some people are calling this the real entry of Twitter into Israeli society because it wasn't that popular before. But now, of course, much of the organization is taking place on Twitter. And so I think the methods of the Arab Spring are certainly taking hold. And I can tell you that in the months preceding this, you know, this didn't truly come out of nowhere. I mean, the actual trigger of the woman who pitched her tent, Daphne Leaf, well, you know, came out of nowhere. But again, I've been noticing for about 2 years now that various groups in Israeli society had been starting to feel like they were reaching breaking point and had been talking more and more about how we can organize, how we can do things, what kind of protests we can undertake, what sort of initiatives would get people going. And there was a lot of talk during the Arab Spring. You know, we're talking about late January, February, March, April. I attended a number of events and meetings where people talked about what can we do to bring a Tahrir-style uprising here.
Delia, let me ask you this. In what extent is there an awareness of what's been going on in Spain and Greece
mm-hmm.
and even, you know, obviously the Britain stuff, the riots mm-hmm. have actually sort of came after this. But I wonder to what extent there's an awareness of Los Indignados in Spain. And
mm-hmm.
And also, I guess, sort of dovetail with that question, one of the things that's come out of the riots in the UK is that the incredible integration of amazing opulence and not abject poverty, but a complete what it seems a lack of social mobility has sort of increased the tensions. I wonder how much that's at play in Israel as well.
Yeah, and maybe your first question. I cannot tell you that I really heard Israelis discussing the developments in places like Spain and Greece before this. You know, again, with a slightly critical perspective, I will say that Israelis do tend to live in a bit of a bubble. They feel very much inside their own affairs. They are not heavily focused on foreign affairs in the world unless it's, you know, really major. I mean, you know, the crashing, you know, the Wall Street crash and the debt controversy in the U.S. made headlines just briefly, sort of broke through the protests. But before that, I really can't say I heard very much debate, certainly not in the public sphere. I'm not saying the stuff isn't covered on the news, but if you ask an Israeli on the street, which is, you know, partly what I do for a living, I really do not believe the kinds of people who are spearheading this protest were particularly aware of that. Although now what you see, you know, since the protests began, now they're taking inspiration from it and saying, you see, this is like, you know, this is kind of like what they did in Spain here or there. But honestly, I can't say it's a particularly savvy population with a lot of global awareness of that kind of thing. Of course, the Arab Spring is different because that, you know, that's so close to home that everybody was following
right.
it. So that's that. And the question about, is there this sort of rage against, you know, incredible opulence versus the inability to, you know, to even imagine such social mobility. I don't know if that's quite the narrative here. It's not exactly what people are saying. I mean, interesting that most of the protests are against the very, very top level of the pyramid, these tycoons that we talk about and the people
uh-huh.
who own so much of the markets. It's not just directed against the wealthier classes. And I really have seen no sense of anger, for example, at people who just made it big in high tech or those young entrepreneurs that you've talked about. Nobody's discussing them. And I think that's partly because, you know, Israelis feel like those people made it. They just made it through hard work and, you know, they made it through their own initiative. And they're not the people to be angry about. I think, again, the policy debates are just getting started here, and they're focusing largely on housing issues, you know, health and education. I think that the, you know, the much thornier issue of, you know, higher taxes for the rich, et cetera, capital gains taxes, property taxes, inheritance taxes, those are the kinds of things that you're only, I think you're going to start to see a little bit later. But I don't think it's going to, I don't think it's going to turn into a general protest against opulence. Like, I don't think we're really looking at, you know, Bolshevik revolution here. And again, because I think these people really don't truly want a complete revolution of the whole system. I think that they want to be able to join the capitalist system. They want better, you know, social support and social welfare to help boost them into a position where they can do that. And you hear a lot of talk about, you know, money's not everything. This is one of the big signs that I was seeing in the beginning. Money's not everything. We should stop being so greedy. You know, they want the state to help them reach a level where they can live and sort of take part in the capitalist consumer society. They don't necessarily, you know, I don't think they want to change everything here.
So are the protests over? I mean, is this now just sort of been co-opted by the political process or what? And who, and if so, who is the champion? Who is the political champion of these people?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think the protests are over. I think what happened, you know, right now, you know, we're sort of facing a wild card in terms of what's going to happen next. We had this peak of 300,000 people, and then last Saturday night, for the first time, there was no demonstration in Tel Aviv, but instead they held demonstrations all over the country, and they had a pretty good turnout. I think this is going to go on. I don't know if you're going to see, you know, those enormous mass demonstrations again, but what's happening now is that the government is, you know, the government has gone through several stages. The first stage was that they tried to delegitimize the protesters and just write them off as a bunch of left-wingers, but they quickly came to their senses when they realized, you know, there were such massive numbers that it was really a consensus issue, and the polls were showing that it was very much a consensus issue. So what they've done instead is to try to co-opt them by saying, you know, we're on your side. We're listening to you. We are going to establish a committee, which is the first thing that Israel always does whenever there's an issue to be discussed. And the committee is full of experts and, you know, policy people and academics. And the organizers are not sure what to do. You know, they're not sure to trust the government. They're not sure if this is just a way of kind of distracting them or mollifying them. So they've said, well, we'll establish our own committee. It's kind of an opposition committee. And they also have, you know, experts and policy people and academics, although I will say one difference between them is that the alternative committee established by the protesters includes Palestinian citizens, which I think is an important point here because, you know, there are different themes emerging, and one of the themes that's emerging is unity. It's a huge theme. You see it everywhere. And I think little by little there are a lot more questions being raised about unity between all the various citizens of the country and the many different sectors and fragments of our society. So that's where things stand now. They are slowly starting to hash out policy recommendations, which are going to be, you know, again, I think it's going to be slow in coming because when it comes down to it, the kinds of changes they're asking for involve policy wonks. They do not, as I said, I don't really think they involve enormous, you know, changes of the whole system. What they might conceivably change is the political system, and that could be a longer-term process that's set in motion now. So I think if we're looking for quick and dramatic, exciting shifts like we saw in Tahrir and in Egypt, you know, I honestly don't think that that's going to be the outcome. I do think that it, you know, possibly the deepest thing that could happen for Israel is if this leads to further questions about the electoral system, about whether or not Israel might finally find itself right to write a constitution, which it doesn't have, or at least pass some more basic laws, which are stand-in for a constitution that guarantee these kinds of social benefits that Israelis want. Those are the kinds of changes that I've written about this that I think might be long time coming, but I think that the discussions are getting started in a more serious, grassroots-driven way. Is there one particular figure who's coming out of this? Not yet. I mean, you know, the girl who pitched her tent, a 25-year-old woman, I should say, you know, she became a symbol. Do I see her as a political leader? I'm not sure. You know, it's hard to say at this point. I don't really know. I don't get the sense that those are her aspirations. There are various groups who are calling themselves leaders that keep switching a little bit because this really was a very spontaneous movement that grew very quickly. And so there is no one leader that's coming from the people. The person who's taking up the headlines now is the person who's heading up the government-led committee Emmanuel Trachtenberg, who's fairly well respected. But, you know, I have no idea where that will go. What I can tell you is that we're seeing something quite new, I think, in Israeli society and maybe in any society, which is that the first thing Mr. Trachtenberg, Professor Trachtenberg did, the head of the government committee, was he went down to the tents and he sat with them and he said, "You call the shots. Talk to me." And this is a kind of sort of, you know, a kind of public diplomacy, internal public diplomacy process, or maybe, you know, you can, a direct democracy of sorts that I think is really quite groundbreaking for Israel and maybe for many societies. I mean, short of sort of plebiscites or, you know, various referendum initiatives, it's very rare that the citizens have a chance to actually talk to the political leadership who are committed, or so they say, to implementing these policies.
Fascinating. Well, Dalia Shenlin of 972mag.com, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
All right, folks. That is our program for today. Folks, as we move into the members show, I will be talking about the anonymous attack on BART, the protest plan for later today, what's happening in Iraq, the other shoe that may drop on News Corp tomorrow, this anti-gay, I got so much news. And for those of you who are not members, you'll be missing all of it. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Folks, you can not miss it by becoming a member of the Majority Report today at majority.fm. Check it out, won't you please? I need your membership, not just to do the member show, but frankly to do the entire show, to do any element of the show. Also, buy your coffee at justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get your fair trade, organic coffee, tea, chocolate, all of it. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, justcoffee.coop. If you're buying junk through Amazon, make sure you use our link. We get a couple of bucks from that. And also, donateyouraccount.com. Those young upstarts over at Citizens Radio, you can't believe how they're mocking me. And understand, when they mock me, they're mocking you. DonateYourAccount.com. Let us just repost automatically. You never have to worry about it. A segment of our show on your Facebook account or on your Twitter feed. People love it. People love it. You're giving them value. You're spreading the word. You're helping the show. You're coming off, frankly, as a very smart person. I mean, really, people have said stuff to me. I'm not going to get into specifics or who, what they've said, but they said that you're really intelligent. All right, folks, see you on the flip side.